This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Last week's underground collision involving two trains along the Kelana Jaya LRT line was shocking and frightening for everyone involved. But for Datuk Dr. Alzamani Muhammad Idris and hundreds of other medical staff, it was another stressful day on the job as emergency frontliners. And today, Dr. Alzamani, who is a consultant emergency physician at Hospital Kuala Lumpur and head of the Pediatrics Emergency Department at Hospital Tunku Aziza, joins me to share what they went through to help all the patients who were involved in that crisis on that fateful Monday night last week. Welcome, Dr. Alzamani. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you, Juliet, for having me here.
It's an absolute pleasure. So much respect and so much gratitude to all of you frontliners. And, you know, on top of dealing with the COVID crisis, of course, there was another huge emergency last Monday night, when the LRT accident happened. Tell me about that. You know, I know you had just arrived for your shift at HKL, and that's where you first heard about the incident, right? You know, what were your immediate thoughts at that point?
Well, I arrived close to 10 o'clock because I was starting my shift at 10 o'clock. So I went into the department to take the case pass overs from my colleague. But I was immediately told that, oh, doctor, there is a train collision, LRT collision, and there's about 47 patients coming to our department. So I was caught by surprise because I actually didn't catch the message in the WhatsApp group because I was driving to work earlier on. And then I said, okay, let me find out what actually happened. So usually I would go on the ground and look at what's actually happening at the department, whether the patients already arrived. And then I was told that they were, at that point of time, there were already at least three critical patients who just arrived and probably another 20 just steadily coming in. So I went to each zone and then there were doctors before me because we were at a point of shift change. So with that in mind, because it is usually our practice in my department that there is one consultant being on call at night. So I'm supposed to be the consultant on duty at night. So I knew that it's my responsibility. So what I did is that I got some more information because we also run the medical emergency call center at our hospital. So I got first-hand information what's happening on the ground through our ambulance team. Mm-hmm. So at that point of time, I was told that there were 47 casualties from this incident, and then all of them will be sent to our hospital. So with that, I went to each of our zones because the emergency department, we have a, you know, the critical zones, semi-critical zones, and non-critical zones. I started to give them a short briefing and the instruction for everybody to stay back because we shall be receiving this information. Actually, in my mind, what was running in my mind was that, oh my God, we are having pandemic now and we've got COVID patients in our zones and these patients are coming in and not just one by one, but, you know, the whole bulk. But I said, well, as an emergency doctor, we are trained to stay in the eye of the storm. So come what may, we just need to deal with it because we just been living this life of that patients will not come at a scheduled appointment with the diagnosis that you want or at the time that you want. Yep. They will just be there at the door. So with that, I made a briefing of to all the staff of the situation. They all understood. And then we have the supervisors, meaning the assistant medical officers, the nurses, the sisters. And I made a specific instruction that we have no choice but to open bigger places to place these casualties. The basic principle of handling mass casualty incident in the hospital is that open place and put people.
Okay.
So the first thing I did was that I've identified the place to be open. This would mean the extended areas of each zone, whereby that will be the intended areas where we would be managing those patients. and the supervisors will be taking out the canvas beds and all. The sisters will be asked to use a different color of the tech for the patient, because we're going to have a mix up of patients of the, from the incident and from our existing patient. And I made the team leader of each zone that all these people, the ones before the shift and the ones who just arrived for the night shift together, will be led by that team leader, and it will be at his or her disposal to handle and take care of each of the patients that arrive. And I made a special instruction that every patient that arrived from the Eastern, their names and particulars and diagnosis must be written on the board. With that in mind, placed, so I've got specialists who are on duty. They are also working in those zones. And I was lucky because news got out that there were a couple of our specialists who actually, even medical officers, who came from home to join us to assist. There was even specialist who was not from our hospital. I mean, he used to work in our hospital, but his house was nearby. He said, my house is just nearby, so I'll come.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so the houseman, the medical officers, and soon after, as I was handling all this, my hospital director was already there, arrived. My head department, Dr. Mahada, also arrived. What I had to do is just to update them, and then we've got strong support, strong backing from the management, and we continued doing what we were doing, stabilizing the patient and diagnosing the patient, and even requesting for X-rays, imaging, CT scans, getting the bloods, and these were running quite all right. Mm-hmm. I think. Our staff, I would commend them because I knew they were tired because they were looking forward to go home at the end of the shift. But when I made the briefing, I could see that they did not show any resentment on their faces. Rather, they showed eagerness. They were eager to help out. Yeah. So, for me, I mean, I don't think people know what emergency department means out there. I always see it as a microcosm of the society. It's the place where the rich, the poor, and those in between are always there during the time where they, you know, need medical attention the most during emergency. And the people who work in this department, whether they are the lowest rank, the highest rank, the moment we walked into the department, we are just a one team. Yeah. For me, that night, again, I mean, although I see this every day, but when incident like that happened, and it happened before in the past, watching them working just as if they're this one big orchestra, and it's really nice to sing to the song, you know, mm-hmm. and be in harmony. Everyone is working their instruments well. And whenever we need, we just tell our director, and they were our head of department, and they will be supporting us getting whatever that we needed. So it went smoothly, and we got everyone sorted out. Nobody died, and those who needed to go for operation, the surgeons came, the neurosurgeons came, the anesthesiologists came, those from the radiologists assisted us to get all those who were queuing up for the X-rays so we could open more places. The blood centers, they gave us like 20 packs. The lab helped us because we also had to grapple with the pandemic situation we had to test them whether they had COVID or not. And thankfully, nobody got COVID from the ones whom we admitted. In a nutshell, it was a teamwork. It was a hill of a teamwork. And I'm very proud of them. And I'm very proud to be working as a team member in this whole big team.
Yeah, because, you know, everybody just mobilized, you know, like you said, even those who are ending their shift. And already we know, you know, things are so difficult now with the pandemic. Already people are working doubly hard. Finish your shift and now a whole new emergency, and everybody just came together. Like you said, doctors from outside came. Everybody just, and you said, I think, if I'm not wrong, around 400 medical staff in total were there working on that night. Am I correct?
So I tried to count how many staff were there. So I just asked my manager, my middle-level managers, and they said roughly, because we are a huge department, our department, I mean, now we're looking after those who had COVID or those with contacts. We also do swabbings and all. So in each shift, it's about 200 people from all ranks working for this huge number of people. So calculating, I've just doubled it. Probably it's less, but it's just an estimation.
It's still a huge amount of people who came together to sort this emergency crisis. But when did the situation actually subside? You know, I mean, when, I guess, you know, were you told to, was there a call down, I suppose, if that's the right phrase to use?
Yeah, by the time I arrived, it was about 10 o'clock, and the first patient arrived at about 9:30, mm-hmm. about half an hour before I came. And by about midnight, at about 1 o'clock, I think we got everyone seen, diagnosis made, and a couple of them, especially the stable ones, were just waiting for the x-rays. But the more critical ones, they have already completed all the CT scans, the x-rays required, and even the plan for surgery. Even the first patient was already about to be wheeled in to the operation theater. So we've got the nurses who came, and when they asked what they can help me with was to find the beds for all the patients that require admission. Mm-hmm. And that they did. So by 1 o'clock, we've got beds allocated for each patient. For those at that point of time, we already saw which one we predicted would be discharged and who would be admitted. So for those whom we predicted would be admitted, we got beds ready for all of them. And for those who were to be discharged, we managed to get another x-ray center open mm-hmm. nearby that we could bring all of them there and then get them x-ray quickly and then bring all of them back. And once that was done, it was pretty quick for us to discharge them with the medications or MC or follow-up, and that was done. So we actually stood down by 1:38 a.m. So amazing. All in all, it was a drama of about 4 hours that could be sorted out.
What a day at the office for you guys. And I do remember reading, because you also posted about this on your Facebook account. I do remember reading that you had actually been involved in a multi-agency drill back in 2017 with the MRT trains, yeah. right? And it was sort of, I don't know, was that like a weird deja vu for you as well, that experience?
Yeah. Yes. But I thought that we are having a pandemic, there would be some mercy on us not to go through all this, you know. So when I entered, really? So I said, okay. But this was a deja vu of a similar event or incident, mass casualty incident exercise that we had in 2017. Actually, that was an event or a drill, a simulation drill that was conducted not far from the Tun Razak Exchange Center. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's an MRT station. And that was an underground station whereby, there was an accident, just like this incident. And there were all the casualties are in the tunnel. So we had to go down, you know, bring all the casualties up, sort them, or what called triage them, meaning sorting them according to the state of critical, whether they are severely critical, semi-critical or non-critical. And then with the order of bringing those who are more critical, requiring needs first, and then followed by the semi-critical, and then the non-critical will just take them on a bus or something to the hospital. So that incident, I was a judge during the incident and invited expert to evaluate the exercise. And I actually, from my own camera, I took photos and even did a small video for the event, and I still got it. I used that in some of the presentations. I remember I presented that in Singapore, but I never thought that it would happen. But like they say, this law that if you something that can happen will happen, and it happen. It was useful. Plus, we had multiple simulations at our department, actually, for internal disaster, external disaster, as part of the preparedness should we encounter this. Mm. So it's just one of those days.
Yeah. I mean, we watch it on TV shows, right? Like, I think, you know, a lot of us watch Grey's Anatomy or ER, you know, showing my age here. And this is something that really happened, that, you know, you guys were so nimble, so resourceful, so quick. And again, like you said, you know, this is the middle of a pandemic and poop, on top of that, an emergency crisis. And wow, well done to everyone. And I'm sure, of course, you know, there was so much care and attention, you know, shown to the patients themselves, who were obviously, you know, in shock from what had just happened to them as well.
Yes, yes. Usually we do have, in some situations, where, especially if the incident is last long enough, we will summon our psychologists to come in to provide psychological first aid. We call it psychological first aid. But this incident, we noticed it was so fast. It was, I mean, the thing worked so fast that all were sorted out. We were able to send everybody, I mean, the staff home by just in a matter of 4 hours. Mm-hmm. For that matter, we didn't see the need yet at that point of time.
Sure.
But of course, if those who were admitted, if they're traumatized and all, we always have a means to get them referred to our psychologists.
Yeah. Okay. And I know that was just, I mean, you, as you said, you only started your shift at 10 o'clock and all of that happened. And even after that, you had to continue with your regular duties, didn't you?
Yes. Yes. because it's my job lasts until daylight
there
the next
go.
Morning. And I had to handle the so-called dirty zone for those who was for COVID patients or suspected COVID patients throughout the entire country. The emergency department function has changed in terms of the way it functions, whereby every patient that walks through our door would be screened and determine whether they are of dirty or clean. Mm. Dirty meaning that if they have respiratory symptoms, fever symptoms that can be a risk of them having COVID and we do not know it.
Okay.
So that's why we have these two sections that night. Mm-hmm. The ones that we handled were at the clean section, whereby it's non-suspicious for this infectious disease such as COVID. But the ones, the section whereby our staff is handling the COVID patients, those run in parallel. Mm-hmm. And we didn't touch that. So that continued. So I returned to work at that area after sorting this incident. And of course, patients still came in. We had to intubate another two patients that night who were actually COVID patients.
Okay.
Well, that's life in emergency lane.
Gosh, hats off and kudos to all of you. I'm speaking today to Dr. Alzamani Mohamed Idris. He's a consultant emergency physician at Hospital Kuala Lumpur. He's also the head of the Pediatrics Emergency Department at Hospital Tunku Aziza. And he was sharing, you know, how the emergency team mobilized on the night of the accident involving the two LRT trains and, you know, how they responded to the emergency. But we're going to go for a quick break now. And when we come back, we're just going to get Dr. Alzamani's thoughts on how he's been coping with the pandemic and, you know, how physicians like himself have been dealing with this rise in cases and, you know, this continuing pandemic, which has been going on for more than a year now. So we're going to get his thoughts on that after this quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and joining me on the line today is Datuk Dr. Alzamani Mohamed Idris. He's a consultant emergency physician at Hospital Kuala Lumpur. He's also the head of the Pediatrics Emergency Department at Hospital Tunku Aziza. And Dr. Alzamani is, you know, he's on the front lines, basically, you know, emergency physician, seeing all the emergency cases. Just before the break, he shared how he and his team handled the LRT accident and managed to, you know, look after all the patients that were brought into Hospital Kuala Lumpur. But now, Dr. Alzamani, can we talk a little bit about your experiences as an emergency physician, you know, dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic? I mean, how has that been like for you so far?
We live our life one day at a time. The way we handle the emergency department has changed completely. From the moment that we had the onslaught of the COVID-19 patients. So the structure of the hospital has changed. We have a clean area, dirty area. The way we handle the flow of the patient also changed. We have to allocate doctors with the appropriate personal protective equipment at the clean and dirty areas. And how this has been for us, we had no choice but to go through it. I think when it started, we retrained ourselves in many ways to handle this, the PPEs, the way we handle patient for safety, and then using devices for us to make it easier for us to handle patients. I mean, doing the lung ultrasound, doing some tests that we are able to triage a critical COVID patients and non-critical COVID patients. There is a mass screening that we send our team outside every day. What they do is that all COVID-19 patients were screened. They are asked to do this test called the sit and to stand test to see if their oxygen drops when they do that. And then they are subjected to lung ultrasound to see if they have pneumonia, because we can't bring the X-ray to the field. Right. And with those, we're able to determine whether these patients can go to a low-risk center, like in the MAEPS, or they are to be admitted. So I think it's quite taxing for my staff, because they are on the run outside doing that. In the department, we have a special center whereby we see patients who are either COVID positive or they are contacts or suspects, that our staff will be also swabbing them determining whether they can go home and quarantine or admitted. Mm. Our critical areas also, because some of these patients, they come very bad. We also had to have a system in intubating. Intubating means that we place a breathing tube through the throat, just putting this patient to sleep, some medications, and then putting them on ventilator. But that process is risky, because from the throat, all these COVID particles, they can just come and, you know, got spread throughout the room and we are all there. So we had some steps that we changed the way we do it. Like these days we use a video scope device so that we don't have to look the throat directly. You know, we use the device and place the tube in, and there are some steps so that, you know, we have to clamp and that kind of thing. So all this, the way we handle it, not just us, I think throughout the world, has changed. And it does put some stress on us. But the thing about our team is that there's a lot of stress, but we have a great team spirit. We look out for one another as much as we can. We even crack some jokes and... I think when you were mentioning about the drama, I mean, after I shared the incident on my Facebook, people were saying that, oh, this sounds like Korean drama or Grey's Anatomy. But I did go back during last weekend and watch this Korean drama, and I saw that they were angry every 3 minutes. They are angry every 3 minutes. Somebody got scolded. But it's a bit different on our turf, because we do not put stress on our already stressed out staff. Rather, we would try to crack some jokes and laugh about it, and then we go home. Mm-hmm. So it's stressful, but we have good teamwork. We look out for each other, one another, we try to lift our spirits in the hospital. Even we like to share some motivational stories at the end of our rounds. So with that, despite having the stresses, we also find some ways to cope in that manner.
Okay. And I mean, ER professionals like yourself, you know, you're known for being resourceful, quick. But has this been a test for you professionally? You know, I mean, what are some of the challenges and frustrations that you've experienced throughout this whole pandemic?
Yes, I've been swabbed twice for, sometimes the patient that we handle, they do not have symptoms, and we only knew later that the test came back as positive. You know, sure. I had to be quarantined and I was worried for my family. And it's the same with the rest of our staff in that manner. But in any case, taking one step at a time, putting our energy on things which are within our control, we are all right with that.
Okay. And we know that, you know, doctors such as yourself are having to make very difficult decisions now, right? I mean, things are really bad. The situation is terrible. And, you know, you're having to make difficult decisions of, you know, allocating medical equipment, care, you know, you have to decide on these things, right? Do you think that, you know, this is going to come to impact, you know, medical professionals and doctors, I suppose their mental health as well, you know, having to make these sorts of life and death decisions for so many people?
It does. It terribly does, because sometimes we have a few last ventilators, and it scared us because it's tough to make a decision, you know, who the last ventilator will go to, especially if the patient pre-ill situation was, you know, she's still walking, talking. So that would be a tough decision to make. We have stresses and all that, but actually we, handling patients, we just do not have a heart actually to just let they be when we know that there is something more we should try with the resources available. But when we run out of the resources and we don't have much choice, it breaks our heart. And I think that's quite traumatizing to us, because we live with knowing that it was a tough decision, and sometimes it's out of our hands, and we knew if we had more resource, we could have done it better, meaning that we've not exhausted the options. It's just that the resources are not there. We exhausted because we have been out of option because the resource is not there, but if only these are there, yeah, enough for all, it would be easier for us.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, you know, having to, I suppose, you know, when you go back and think about the decisions that you had to make, and that will have a lasting impact on all of you, I'm sure. I guess, is there a way to ensure that doctors, physicians, you know, medical staff, they don't become overwhelmed, or is that already just out the window? I mean, you guys are just overwhelmed as it is.
Yeah, my colleagues, especially in the ICU, I know they are overwhelmed, their medical ward. Right now, we keep on opening wards. The elective surgeries have been stopped. You know, their wards are taken over, changed into COVID beds, ICUs, beds added. It's very stressful situation. And we still carry on. But we wish and hope things would be so bad. I mean, we have seen situation like in India that even the oxygen is not enough.
Yeah.
And that's heartbreaking. And we don't want to see that here. So far, I think my colleagues, our staff, will still soldier on. We would battle it out. But we hope it doesn't get to a point that they will just cannot bear it anymore. At this point of time, they still do. I know they are quite strong people. All of us are bound by our code of ethics in handling patients. And it actually makes us happy when we are able to handle the patients well. But it just gives us a lot of dissatisfactions and bad memories if we were not able to give it all for our patients. So I hope it doesn't get worse. And I tried. I knew what we do as doctors in the healthcare line is that we cannot win this battle. We cannot win the COVID-19 pandemic battle. We only manage the product of the battle. the casualties, the patients. But the ones who could win this battle are the people out there, you, and you. Because if you are strict with the SOPs, you do not let any gap with your SOPs. For example, some people say they adhere to SOP, they wear masks and everything, but during makan time, they will be eating with their friends very close by, less than a meter. And then, you know, that is where your gap is. And many are like that.
Okay.
They quietly went for Raya visit. And even when they do outdoor activities like jogging, you know, I saw some who actually walk close by and they were having conversation throughout that walk. I mean, this is science. You know, you open the gap for the COVID virus to transmit. It will transmit. It's all like fire. If you have the wood and the wood is nearby, the fire will continue. Now, the wood are people. If you stay out, stay away from the people, the fire will stay away from wood and the fire will just stop. Mm. But we fail to close the gap. And hence, this keep on happening. But if we understand, we close the gap, we stop it, all opportunities, we shall win. Not us, but you will win it for us, the people out there.
Yeah. So well said, Doctor. I mean, that is exactly what's happening, right? We think like, okay, we're following all the SOPs. I wear my mask in public, but oh, and I'm with my friends, I'm not going to do it. Magically, why? I mean, obviously, your friends also could potentially have it, right? They may be asymptomatic as well. So you should never let your guard down, basically. I mean, just because they're your friend.
Yeah, trust no one, especially the ones you trust most. Because we have seen, you know, the son visited the mother, then the mother got COVID. Mm-hmm. And the son was not having symptoms, but later on got symptoms. And then the whole of his family got COVID and the mother got COVID. So there were friends who visited, a close friend, and then they ate together, and then he went back. And then they were in their 70s, you know. So this close friend got COVID, and he died. Mm. So this friend who visited him just kept apologizing to the family and feeling bad because he survived. So trust no one, because this is how the virus operates. Like Trojan horses, you know, they will be in a human and we do not know that they are in that human and that human will bring it to you. So be careful of those who came from somewhere else, even though they are your family member. This is not a safe time. This is a time that we need to stay away from people to be safe.
I would say don't trust yourself. You know, you don't know. You may feel fine, but don't take that chance. Yes.
That's brilliant. Don't even trust yourself. I don't even trust myself. You know? Yeah, really, I don't trust myself. That's if I came across a family member, it's me that I worry. I work at the hospital. I got vaccinated, but we all know that 95% of those vaccinated, they wouldn't get COVID, but there's still a chance of 5%, and I may be that person. So I also didn't visit my mom during the Raya, and it's all right to just battle it out, wait it out. But the outcome is that you still have your loved ones around when all this is over. It will be over, and it will be over sooner if we are steadfast with our SOP. We get the vaccines done, and next year will be a better year for us.
Okay, all right. I'm just curious, you know, has there been any silver lining for you at all during this current situation? Anything, maybe it's, you know, involving your staff or, you know, all the people that you've come into contact with, you know, has there been any silver lining at all?
The silver lining that I always see is that my staff, their spirits, their camaraderie, the teamwork, that for me is the silver lining. And the last incident of the LRT accident showed that multiple times more. And I can't ask for anything more, because we had this great teamwork, team spirit. That come what may, we are one, we are united. Probably when I wrote those small little article on my Facebook trying to share it, this is my message. to Malaysia, perhaps, that we do it at the hospital as one team, and we need Malaysians to battle this this war as one team. And you battle this war not with rifles, not with tanks. You battle this war with your SOPs, your steadfast, gapless SOPs, and you get in line with the vaccination. Even if you're not vaccinated yet, those gapless SOP is your vaccine, the external vaccine. And even after you got vaccinated, you still need to be steadfast with that SOP, because you can still get COVID until 80% of our people get immunized. Then we got a herd immunity, and that will be a point we can take off and throw away our mask, and we can visit our loved ones. But that time will come. But the faster we do this, the more perfect we perform this, then we're going to win this battle much faster than we thought. Okay. It's in your hands, and you can, because it's not a fight with bad rifles or tanks. It's a fight with your mask and staying away from people.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing, Dr. Alza. And, you know, I know that you also recently released a book, actually, about all of your experiences as an emergency physician. Am I right? Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah. Last year, it was during the COVID time. My book, I had this collection of stories, just like the stories of this LRT incident, because for me, I see myself like a photographer, but I do not photograph photos. I photograph emotions. Mm-hmm. I photograph the character, people. I photograph humor. I photograph sadness. I photograph happiness. And all that I photographed in words, I penned it down and kept as a collection of true stories throughout my 20 years of experience as an emergency doctor. So this LRT incident is just one episode of such story that could be found in that book. That book is called Crisis as well. Okay. But it was written in Malay. I mean, actually, there were also originally came from English articles that I wrote, but I put them in Malay first. But probably in the future, I would have it in the English version. There were past experiences such as this in that book. For example, I had a situation whereby I had to negotiate with a drug addict who got a 12-year-old girl with a knife.
Holding her hostage?
Yes, at hostage, with a knife at her throat. The police called because they had negotiated, and they thought it's good to have a doctor to negotiate. So when they called me, I had to call the psychiatrist on call because I thought they're better. The medical officer from the psychiatry department followed me. I sent her. But at the time when we got there, she got a call from the boss, actually negotiating with this outside the hospital is not under their jurisdiction. But I could understand because she may not be experienced and things could turn back. But when I was there at the incident site, I know the girl is in the room, and I was told the guy was shirtless, was not wearing, well, initially was told not wearing clothes, but I can't walk away from there. Mm-hmm. And I continued to negotiate, making him a friend. We kind of connected along the way. And later on, the psychiatrist arrived and managed to get the windows open and all, but he became more angry. Okay. And then the sharpshooters were all there, and they said, "Doctor, it's getting dark. If you could just distract him, we could get him." So because we kind of made friends and we managed to, you know, separate him away, and they finally shot him, and the door was broken, and then they entered and brought the girl out first, harmless. And then we brought the guy, was shot, and then we had to CPR him on the way to the hospital. and both of them were at the hospital. And so these are some of the crisis situations. Wow. And there and some incidents like there was a bus that went into in Genting Highland, you know, that fell into a valley.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Yeah, so we were also alerted just like this, mass casualty incident. There were situations, other situations, like we had some nerf gas situation during a drill practice. We some experiences during humanitarian works whereby some are memorable, like I had a friend who was actually trained as an engineer, but he didn't work as an engineer. He just liked to entertain kids by being a clown. So we went to Iran during an earthquake, and we got children who got post-traumatic stress disorders. They were not talking for months. And then he wore all those red noses and everything, and then appointed me as the deputy clown. And and then we went around and trying to, you know, clown around in the field hospital. And then the children started to talk.
Amazing.
So, yeah, so things like that. Or even the Everest, that I was once an expedition doctor for Everest Malaysian Everest climbers. And there were all the challenges that they had, you know. And then when finally, you know, you got snow blind, they got avalanche and everything. And but finally, the group managed to summit the Mount Everest. So these are some crises, I would say, that were, became a collection of the book. And I suppose the experiences of handling such crises throughout the career helped when we face another crisis like what we see today at the department.
Okay, all right. And that book is available, right? How can we get our hands on it?
It's available on Shopee.
Shopee, all right. Okay, so just search for crisis?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, all right. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but thank you so much for joining me today and for sharing your experiences. And, you know, I guess, you know, maybe one last message you'd like to give to everyone who's sitting at home, and what would your message be to them?
Okay, I believe in you. Let's win this war, and let's be united as one people. I mean, we are Malaysians. And when we fight, we battle this pandemic war, if we battle it right as one, then we will win this together, just like we win that night when we had the LRT collision as one team.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Dato' Dr. Alzamani Mohamad Idrus. He's a consultant emergency physician at Hospital Kuala Lumpur. He's also the head of the Pediatrics Emergency Department at Hospital Tunku Aziza. And he was sharing his experiences as a frontliner. And I think Dr. Alza has a Facebook page, and you can follow him on Facebook, you know, for updates. Any other social media channels, Dr. Alza?
Right, some on Twitter and a bit of Instagram, but most of the sharings on the Facebook, little stories, humors, things like that to distress us out.
Okay, all right. So just search for Dr. Alzamani Mohamad Idrus on Facebook, and keep updated with him through Facebook and through other social media. And if you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, do search for the podcast on the BFM app or at bfm.my/learn. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.